Well, let's return to our visit to the Grand Rapids of 1916, 100 years ago. And as we have seen, high hopes were still being placed on possibilities of farming as providing major economic support for Itasca County and for Grand Rapids. And as the iron mines of the western Mesabi continued to yield profitable tons of ore, speculation continued that mining would also be a major adjunct to the economic well-being of Grand Rapids. The Jones and Laughlin Mining Company mined small ore deposits west of Grand Rapids for a very short time, and the underground exploration continued. In 1916, the Herald Review commented that there's every reason to suppose that Grand Rapids is to become an important mining center. Well, that's way, way, way too over-optimistic. And as we have seen in our earlier programs, Coleraine, of course, has established itself as the mining center for the western Mesabi. Actually, hopes that developing the recreational potential of the region would lead to economic growth were far more realistic than those pinned either to large-scale agricultural or nearby mining operations. By 1916, many resorts and hunting lodges had been built in the area, but efforts to bring tourists to Itasca County and to turn Grand Rapids into a recreational headquarters had not been carried out systematically. The beauty of Lake Pocagama and the establishment of Camp Mishawaka on its shores focused national attention on the region, underlining for the residents of Grand Rapids the possibilities for catering to the tourist trade. Unlikely person behind this. George F. Green, athletic director of the Episcopal Cathedral School in Washington, D.C., built the camp, and each summer he and his carefully selected professional educational staff supervised some 50 boys from various East Coast and Midwestern cities. By 1916, Camp Mishawaka was so popular that Green was receiving applications for summer reservations from the parents of 2 and 3 year old boys. Those parents wanted to be certain their children would have the opportunity to spend some months in Itasca County. Reflecting community interest, the Independent carried occasional columns on activities at Mishawaka. The businessmen and residents of Grand Rapids were intrigued with the special train cars that brought the young visitors each year, and they became even more aware of the impact of tourist dollars when parents, also enjoying northern Minnesota, stayed in the Grand Rapids area while visiting their boys in camp. Let's browse a bit in a 1916 advertising brochure for Camp Mishawaka. It is the aim of Camp Mishawaka to lay foundations for future men. The problem of the value of a pleasant, profitable, and wholesome summer vacation for a boy is in practical terms solved by the summer camp, where the boy may enjoy himself, where he may exercise mind and body under most favorable conditions. Parents may feel safe in trusting their sons to the care of trained college men who watchfully guard their surroundings and personally direct the youthful energy into channels of self-reliance, manliness, and truth. Camp Mishawaka is unsurpassed for beauty of location and for the variety of sports and trips that it offers, supplemented at the same time with the culture and refinement of a home. Camp Mishawaka is situated on Pocagama Lake in what is known as the Lake Region of northern Minnesota, 95 miles northwest of Duluth. It will be consistent purpose of the camp to set a good table. Fresh milk, butter, eggs, and vegetables are furnished from nearby farms. That certainly is an up-to-date feature there of 100 years ago. Ordinarily, 2 boys occupy each tent. There will be larger tents for 3 boys and 4 boys and the consular. The younger boys will be placed in the larger tents with an instructor who constantly looks after their welfare. The fleet consists of an ample number of canoes, rowboats, motorboats, and a large sailboat. It's interesting how to get there. Special cars will be chartered from Chicago and Milwaukee. Boys enrolled from various points should make connections with this train at either Chicago or Milwaukee. The train will go by way of St. Paul and then on to Duluth. There, the coaches will be coupled onto the train on the Great Northern Railway, arriving at Grand Rapids. Full charge for the season of 8 weeks is $125. Well, Camp Mishawaka continues and continues to flourish, and I checked to see what the rate is today. It is a little bit more. For 8 weeks today, the cost is $8,500. So, yes, a little bit of increase. Well, Camp Mishawaka certainly did play a role in the touristic aspects of development in Grand Rapids, and so did the Ogegama Hotel, which was also located on the lake and was backed by Grand Rapids interests and represented an early effort to attract tourists. They had a dancing pavilion, a swimming beach, and canoes, boats, launches, bathing suits, all for rent. The resort was popular with Grand Rapids citizens looking for a day's outing, while the hotel's accommodations appealed to out-of-town visitors. The Independent cited the Ogama as keenly appreciated and as an attraction that would pave the way in making Lake Pokegama one of the biggest resort areas of northern Minnesota. The Herald Review was a strong supporter for developing tourism in Itasca County. A 1916 article pointed out that deer were still plentiful and that in some places the hunting remained as good as it had been 30 years earlier. Moose hunting, many kinds of game birds, and the best of freshwater fish still made the region of clear and unpolluted waters a sportsman's paradise. The advent of the automobile had as much impact on Grand Rapids as it did everywhere else in the United States, and this too helped the tourism industry as it made the region more easily accessible to tourists and sportsmen. A 1916 Herald Review editorial noted, "We are only a comfortable day's journey from the Twin Cities, a day and a half from northern Iowa and the farms of southern Minnesota. Stories about automobiles, roads, accidents, car thefts, and mechanical details provided interesting reading for the people of Grand Rapids, and the local newspapers seldom failed to carry their weekly quota of such reports." Jeweler Will Nisbet, we have met him before when he was touring by dog sled and selling his watches to various lumber camps scattered around, owned the first automobile in Grand Rapids. He purchased a one-cylinder Oldsmobile steered by a lever protruding from the dashboard. The muffler was not the best attribute of the vehicle, and the noise it made when the car began to puff and snort in going up a grade drove all the animals in the vicinity and many of the more timid persons to refuge at a good distance. When heading for Lake Pokegama on summer excursions, all passengers had to climb out and push the machine up Powers Hill while Nisbet steered and enjoyed the ride. Here's a very intriguing story from Lawrence Rossman, and he is writing in 1938. He says, "These days, a trip to Minneapolis by automobile is not an event. It takes about 4 hours, and many travelers journey forth and back the same day. Back in the summer of 1909, the first trip from Minneapolis to Grand Rapids was made by automobile. At that time, there were two automobiles in Grand Rapids. Will Nisbet owned one, and Dr. Charles Storch owned a Buick. F.E. King of the King Lumber Company decided that he wished to buy a car at Minneapolis and that he would drive it to Grand Rapids rather than having it shipped up by train. Mr. King, accompanied by Dr. Storch, one of the few men in town who knew how to drive an automobile, went to Minneapolis. They arrived there on a Monday, and a deal was made for a Buick. However, it was Friday before the car was ready. Extras had to be purchased. A top was an extra. There were many things that an automobile needed in those days. The car cost $1,750 as it stood, and when the extras were added, the cost was about $2,200. On Saturday afternoon, the journey began. A man was hired to guide the car through St. Paul to the highway leading to Duluth. By late nightfall, the party had made its way to Rush City, where the night was spent. The next day, bright and early, the car was made ready, cranked up, and along with many inquiries, the road was followed to Duluth. On Monday morning, a good start was also made. To make the Thompson Hill out of Duluth was considered a great stunt. It was not a question as to which gear would be used in making the hill. It was a question whether the car could make it at all on its own power. But they did make it up, and then headed for Eveleth. So in the summer of 1909, no direct roads, no direct way to get from Duluth to Grand Rapids yet at that point. In Eveleth, they spent another night, and then all day Tuesday was required to drive from Eveleth to Grand Rapids. The highway wandered in and around mines, lakes, and hills. And when that historic trip was made, there was not a single filling station between St. Paul and Minneapolis and Grand Rapids. Blacksmith shops and some stores had a barrel or so of gasoline, which was to be drawn out in a gallon can. The tires, which cost $60 each with an inner tube, did well if they went 2,000 miles. It was not until about 1916 that there was a direct road from Grand Rapids to the Twin Cities. The first highway could not be used in wet weather because of conditions in the swamp this side of Aiken. So, major undertaking, certainly, to drive from Grand Rapids to the cities still as late as 1916. By 1916, more than 250 automobiles were registered in Itasca County. Because of the new interest in cars, road construction and maintenance became a topic of much concern. Converting wagon trails designed for oxen and horses into roads suitable for the rather flimsy cars was a major project and expense for both state and county. So northern Minnesota residents took Good Roads Day, an annual state event, very seriously. An editorial in the Herald Review stressed that good roads are now regarded as not only desirable, but absolutely necessary. If one were asked what three factors were most essential for the enjoyment of the citizens of our state, the reply would be good roads, good roads, good roads. The personal desire of the residents of Grand Rapids for decent roads was evident in the response to a 1916 proclamation issued by Mayor Aiden. He summoned all patriotic men of the town to appear at the village hall early in the morning on a Saturday in June, from there to go or be conveyed to the places appointed to labor as long as is necessary. Some 85 men drawn from every walk of life loaded gravel onto wagons and unloaded and smoothed it into the roadbed from Grand Rapids to Coleraine until late in the afternoon. The newspaper reported a strong feeling of comradeship among the men, and that even though many expected blisters and sore backs, all had been enthusiastic. Well, despite the support for building roads and the interest in cars in Grand Rapids, no one really visualized the full potential of well-developed highways and larger, heavier, and more reliable vehicles. David Joyce, who had built an elaborate retreat north of town, was visited by his good friend, famed racing car driver Barney Oldfield. The two men tried to set a speed record on the way back from a trip to Minneapolis in Joyce's Cadillac. The Herald Review reported that with Oldfield at the wheel, they had traveled from Minneapolis to Brainerd, a distance of about 125 miles, in 3.5 hours before they were delayed by blowouts. Without that problem, the article proudly but quite naively continued, probably a record for all time would have been set. You know, the automobile was indeed just beginning to make its impact felt. And next time, once again, back to Grand Rapids in 1916.